The Devil is in the Details, The Art of Deception, an original story by Thomas Hessler. It really wasn't a wild prank. Nobody got hurt, some were entertained for a while, and the incident displayed a principle of human characteristics. I would do it again, and I think if you ask those who know me, they would say, uh-huh. Every so often I pick up a book about writing. I mean, some of the authors might really have something to say that is helpful. One author was explaining that no matter how unbelievable the plot might be, you sell the reader by plying them with details. The author provided several examples, and I remembered a novel that I had read. The back cover's summary of The Invasion said that in this story, the Chinese invaded the United States and created havoc in doing so. Now, this was 20 years or so ago, and the Chinese military and technology were not as robust as now. So, I scoffed, it would be hard for me to believe. Nevertheless, I read the novel and, bit by bit, induced by references to actual situations, detailed accounts of confrontations, familiar political history, and scene-by-scene narration, I bought into it. I remember remarking at the time that the author had convinced me that Chinese invasion was not a warp of reality. It could be done. Well, sometimes you actually put into practice that which you have read and understood. Thereafter, when writing, I remembered to craft some detail to convince the reader when the plot might be stretching things. But I yearned to prove the point in a bigger way. It so happened I was working on a story in which an American engineer escaped from Iran, crossing the mountains into Turkey. The escape occurred soon after the Shah was deposed, and the Ayatollah had taken over. I had done a fair amount of research of the history, read accounts of the captured hostages, and had read the saga of our disastrous attempt to rescue the hostages in the Desert One caper. Additionally, I'd been to Iran not too long before all this happened. I began to assemble a story in which I, not the person in my story, was the main character. A story of a situation not experienced by most people and, therefore, not easy to believe. I needed an opportunity to tell this fabrication, as in face-to-face, and I had not yet found an appropriate one, but I did additional research to reinforce the story, provide more detail. Could my friends be convinced that this escapade might have actually happened in my past before they knew me? It would be worth a try, no harm done. I was well bolstered and now looking for an opportunity to spring it. The opportunity unraveled right in front of me, with not much maneuvering on my part. It happened on a hiking group trip to the deserts of eastern Nevada. We stayed overnight in Elko for several nights, hiking the Ruby Mountains from that location. One night, a bunch of us decided to go to a local restaurant for dinner. When we got there, we were told there would be a 20-minute wait. No worry, we'll spend some time jawing at each other. One of the hikers, Maisie, a normally quiet and analytical type, commented that her husband liked to tell tall stories, just like someone in our present company. I said, Maisie, you have the perfect opportunity to pull a shenanigan, put one over on him. Since you don't ever tell stories, especially tall stories, you will be quite believable, and when John reels all this one, you'll have created the perfect payback. Maisie said, I can't do that. I'm not a storyteller. I shrugged. Yes, you can. You just need to get prepared. Think of a story, maybe even an outrageous story, and fill it in with details, especially details. I stated, as if it were a universal truth, outrageous stories are believed when told with details. That's how you entrain the person hearing or reading the story. It is a basic storytelling tenet. It wasn't just Maisie hearing this. The five others were also listening, chuckling at the thought of the demure Maisie telling an outrageous story. Brandon, Donna, Nick, Daniel, and Emily all joined in on the fun, encouraging Maisie to give it a try. Maisie stared at me with accusing eyes. You'd like to see me get in trouble, wouldn't you? And you're having fun at my expense. I had now spotted a great opportunity to engage my own detailed story spoof. Realizing such, I plied more fodder about detail being the vehicle to sell the outrageous. I gave them the example of the Chinese invasion and other situations. Maisie still would not agree that she would pull her own spoof. It was not her character. Oh, but it would have been perfect. We were eventually summoned to take our seats in the dining room. After being seated, we ordered beer, wine, water, Jack Daniels, and coffee. I let some time pass. We were well into dinner when I heard an opportunity to introduce my subject matter. Dinner table conversation with the hikers often rambled amongst topics that seemed to have no connection, no stream of consciousness. Something was bound to lead the way. So, as you might hope, Brandon had just led discussion on a recent international incident in which the Western world once again challenged Iran to cease building a bomb. I held my finger aloft, as if to bookmark the moment and save my place. Then, after a deliberate pause, I said, "Guys, you are going to be the first to hear this. Some time ago, in a past life, I was involved in Iran and ended up being engaged in activity that was classified. I was told that it would remain classified for 25 years. Actually, it's been 27 years. Nevertheless, this last week I received a memo from the State Department saying that the classification had been lifted. Now, there are two things to consider here. One is that I used 27 years instead of 25. Most could easily agree that the government would not hit the 25-year mark on the noggin. The other notion is that these people all knew I'd been in Iran. I'd talked about my experience, in a casual way, several times over the years, so I felt this added credibility to what I was going to say. Hopefully I was bringing them along. The hikers were interested. Yes, several had transferred their focus from chili and coleslaw to me. Always a good sign. I continued. I was drafted into the army and ended up involved in a missile testing program. After I'd tracked the missiles through rock and sand for 8 months, we heard that some technical information involving our testing program had been compromised. Information had been passed on to a third party. I told the hikers. I was surprised when the G2 Army intelligence people came to me and said they were doing some additional checking on my background. Well, okay, what the hell's all that about? The next contact was from Army intelligence in Washington, D.C. The contact was an administrative type, got no answers from him, but he said that I would receive orders to travel to the D.C. offices. I said to myself, now that's pretty intriguing. The hikers inadvertently tightened the circle. I was getting stares that begged me to go on, so I did. I did eventually get orders to travel. My work section didn't know anything, although Captain Swanson told me that I was being considered for a special assignment. Yes, they were. Special it was. They wanted me to go to The Hague in the Netherlands, an established espionage hangout, to act as an agent interested in buying information such as we had lost. The espionage agent's universal language was German. So, because I looked German, knew a little German, and was technically deep in the missile program, I was thought the best fit for the task. I did it. Well, I had to brush up on my German and get schooled on how I was supposed to let it be known that I needed the information. 2 weeks later, I was in The Hague trying to snare some espionage agents from we didn't know where. I was never successful in doing that, but I enjoyed the hell out of The Hague, the art gallery, with the 360-degree display of murals, the Maxim restaurant, the Binnenhof. One of the hikers, Emily, had spent time in the Netherlands, and was able to nod her head and acknowledge the notable features of The Hague. I don't know if the Maxim restaurant is still there, but it was one of my favorites, she said. Okay, but that episode was not the superclassified mission. It led into it, however. I returned to my regular assignment at White Sands. When my army time was up, I was recruited by an electronics firm that had obtained a contract to install what is called a multi-array radar system. We called it MARS. I had been involved in testing the MARS system at White Sands. In those days, the U.S. was fortifying the Shah with defense systems to defend against, of all people, the Iraqis. The electronic outfit selected me because I did have some background in multi-array radar and because of the background check that Army intelligence had done for the Hague caper. At this time, Brandon eagerly offered, "I know about multi-array radar. We had a program involving MARS when I worked for NASA." I nodded. "Pretty impressive, huh?" Brandon said, "Well, I'll be darned. What did they want you to do?" Of course, this added substantial credibility to my story. I forged ahead. They wanted me to go to Iran and test the system after installation. Several sites were involved, along the Zagros Mountains and a facility near Tabriz to face a direct westerly challenge. Nick asked, "What was the time frame?" 1978 and 79, I responded. The Shah was still in power, but it was only a short time before he was deposed. I nodded my head. And that was the problem. While I was over there, interesting trip by the way, I traveled between several sites, performing sequential startup and testing procedures. Abruptly, the Shah was out, a new regime was in, and there were 52 hostages. My best move would have been to get out of there, but the Iranians I was working with pleaded for me to stay and even put a little pressure on me to do so. That's another story. I remained. Donna asked, "Did you think you could get out without any problem?" I didn't know. The company I worked for didn't know. It wasn't certain how we could make an escape attempt work. People were leaving, on airplanes even, but they had diplomatic cover. I'd heard that some had just bolted by car for borders with Turkey or Iraq or Turkmenistan. I paused to eat a few bites, the others impatient, and only slightly permitting me the courtesy of doing this. After taking a swig of Jack D, I continued. I needed a plan. It was possible the situation could get much worse for me, and I could imagine years in captivity of some type. A slave who would fix their radar system for food and promise of no ill treatment. If you know the geography of the area, you understand that Tabriz is just over the mountains from Turkey. It wasn't that far, I was thinking. I acquired some maps on the sly. Yes, some rugged going, but perhaps that would give me a better chance to elude a search party. Also, when in Tabriz, I would often go hiking in the mountains, so continuing this pattern might provide the opportunity. Nick asked, "What time of year was it?" It was now May, 6 months beyond the takeover. Agreed, because of the snow runoff, it was not the best time to take a trek 100 miles across rugged mountains and rushing streams. But what was I going to do? Wait. So, for the time being, I remained. I considered whether I should leave the sites disabled or corrupted. I mean, it was clear Iran was now an enemy of the U.S. But because I was on remote sites, nobody but the Iranians working there saw me and knew that there was an American amongst their midst. Those who I worked for were able to fly below the radar, so to speak, and did not have to explain to higher-ups what an American was doing working on their defense system. Before the takeover, an Israeli agent once confronted me in the market at Esfahan. He asked if I would be willing to provide him information about the Irani radar sites. I understood his interest, of course, and although I was sympathetic to his concern, I would not give him any information. It seemed like it would be a security violation. He'd offered money, and I knew I'd be in hot water if I got paid for giving him any tech data. However, after the takeover, when working on the mid-Zagros facilities, I was again walking the streets of Esfahan in an after-hour jaunt. I recognized the Israeli agent walking towards me, and he was intent on making sure I did so. He motioned for me to follow him, and we stood at a market stall, studying melons, to deflect the interest of those who might be watching. He said, "Your government needs your help. At Tabriz, you will be contacted for a safe conversation." I was dumbstruck. Why would my government need my help? I could only hope that they would try to get me out, but that's not what it sounded like. I anticipated my next trip to Tabriz in 3 days. How would I be contacted? As it turned out, an Iranian, Farid, one who had been part of my testing crew, was the one who contacted me. He confronted me outside the radar dome while checking line-of-sight orientations to calibrate the radars with the compass. He said to me, "Your country is planning to rescue the hostages in Tehran. Of course, they will come in using aircraft. They are asking if you can provide a path over the Zagros that will have the best chance of not being detected. This is not a low-level planning group. It is being headed up by Zbigniew Brzezinski." I avoided looking at the tech. My answer was easy. Yes, not only yes, but hell yes. He then said it would be most useful if the information could be provided within the next 3 days. I was to give the information to him as I could no longer communicate with my company or any other entity outside my work. Okay, I understood. I would not be at the Mid-Zagros sites during the next 3 days, but I had all the information to give them what they wanted. I worked it out. If the flyers flew low before the Zagros, then climbed the slopes in a terrain-hugging maneuver, they would have the best chance. After the Zagros, they would be beyond the new radar. I told Farid. At that time, I didn't have details as to the mission and didn't know when it might occur. Farid said they would find a way to let me know the timing. To stay discreet, I was now codenamed Polaris, and it would be ever so nice if I could also disable the radar at the designated time. Of course, that option would be dependent on my being at the proper site. I would need a week's notice to make that arrangement. Not workable. Instead, when at the site near Esfahan, I introduced a blind spot into the radar sweep, undetectable unless you looked at the electronics bit by bit. It was clear that I must get out soon after the rescue attempt. The Iranians would surely suspect me of providing radar information, and even worse, manipulating the equipment. I would not have much time. I needed to be in Tabriz, now. So here's what I did. I continued my hikes when in Tabriz, but now, each time I took off for a hike, I took extra provisions in my backpack, nothing obvious, nothing my associates would notice. I'd take supplies, extra hiking gear, and such to a cache well beyond the trailhead. They got it. They were nodding their heads. I have to admit I had to fight the tendency to smile, put that out of my mind. The smile would derail the tale, of course. I went on. After three such provisionings, I thought I was ready, although I was nervous about making my move as it could easily end in disaster if they caught up with me. Yet, hanging around didn't seem a good option either. From the rough topo layout I had, and thinking the going might be rough, I thought it would take me 7 days to make the 100-mile trip. There was a road south of Tabriz that headed for Turkey, but that's a route they might expect me to take. My better chance was in the mountains. Now to wait for the alert, my Iranian contact in Tabriz said I would get some warning, that is, Polaris would, several days ahead of the maneuver. I would do my best to get to Tabriz at, or just after that time. Then it happened. I mean, Desert One did, and it was a disaster. I hoped that I hadn't helped to contribute to that. Of course, I heard about it. In fact, I'd been informed as to when it would happen, 2 days before. I managed to get to Tabriz. After the failed attempt to rescue the hostages, the Iranians put a shadow on me. At Tabriz, he followed me everywhere. I made one last trial hike and cached food that was fresh. As I suspected, my shadow, Tehrani, stayed at the trailhead and, lazy bastard that he was, would not go with me on the hike. I would make my break 2 days after that. I was already overstaying my time in Tabriz, and I'd heard that they wanted me to check the operation of the radar at Zagros. I filled my pack with additional provisions, and with Tehrani, walked to the trailhead. I nodded, told him I'd be back in 2 hours, and I was off. I hiked as fast as I could. The mountains were rugged, there were no maintained trails, and as it was May, snow runoff was strong. I had a hard time crossing many of the streams. I was constantly cold, but kept moving as long as I could, stopping to sleep for only a few hours, but often clawing my way along frozen riverbanks, hand over hand on rocks, charging my way through the brush, trying to follow the route I'd crudely planned from the sparse maps that I had. As much as I tried to hurry, it did take me 7 days before I descended the canyon, looking west to a flatter plain that I knew must be Turkey. I was still wary, but I thought I'd made it. There was still no route or road or trail. But after walking for a while in what had to be Turkey, I encountered a road and walked it. Soon, a truck rambled by, and I did my best to convince the Turks that I wanted to get to a town. They drove me to Van. At this time, one of the hikers, Daniel, said, "I know Van." This hiker was Armenian, and he well knew the history, that the Turks had run his people out of Van just after World War I. Of course, this just helped my story along a little bit more. I continued, "So they took me to Van and to the police station. I told the police my story. After I provided more details, unlimited questions, it seemed they were convinced. They arranged passage to Ankara, to our embassy. At Ankara, I was debriefed, although it seemed like they were instructed not to dig too deep into what exactly I'd been up to. Only that I was an American citizen who'd escaped from Iran. I went through another debriefing in New York from some individuals who were higher in the chain. I was not to reveal my part in Desert One. The restriction would be lifted in 25 years. It was for my protection, they said. Somehow, between syllables, I'd managed to eat my chili. I looked at the group, some wide-eyed and some with blank looks, and said, "There you have it. Anybody going to have dessert?" There weren't too many comments or questions. I was considering the timing for telling them it was a hoax, a tall story. It was clear to me that the detail did sell the story, and it should be clear to them too. I decided to wait until the following morning. At breakfast, I approached them, one or two at a time, and fessed up. Three of them said they really did know it was a spoof, but were just reluctant to say anything. Oh yes, it is so hard to fool some people, the know-it-alls. In making the explanation, I referred to the conversation we'd had before dinner about details. Several smiled. They got it. But wait, there's more. It wasn't too long after that that I went to a reunion of my fourth grade class. At the function, after a glass of wine or two, each of us was to describe our lives since the fourth grade. All the Iran details were fresh in my mind, so I decided to go for it. When I was in the Army, I was recruited by Army intelligence to be a spy. I was sent to The Hague. A friend of mine said, "That's not true. Busted." What could I do? I just smiled and took a sip of wine. I told them I was going to tell them how I escaped from Iran, and at the end of my story, I would say, "Now I write fiction." My intent would be that they would understand that I had crafted the story, but I didn't get there. Afterwards, however, several surrounded me saying, "You had me pulled in. I was waiting for more." I shot dagger eyes at my friend. One more episode weighs in. On a trip to Turkey, as we traveled along the Iranian border, I told my traveling companions about my story. We had a fun time trying to spot the canyon that I descended on my way out of the mountains. So, storytellers, I am convinced that detail works wonders. It takes a little more digging, but it may be worthwhile. It is hard to tell the story with a straight face. And there are consequences. You have a hard time convincing others thereafter, even if you are telling the truth. A choice that is yours. Ain't we got fun?